there, all you hip cats, cool kittens, disciples of cool, and true believers. This is the Theatrical Magic Podcast, and today's episode is The Performance Coach, and we have a very special episode. We're doing something brand new. We've never done this before. We're hosting a roundtable on the creative process, and we've got some friends with us, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves in a moment. First off, from the Midwest is Josh Shaken.
This is Josh. As Big Eddie Cool said, I'm from the Midwest in the Kansas City area. I've done a lot of work in restaurants as well as various corporate parties and weddings. So I'm primarily a strolling performer. I have put together some close-up and parlor work, which I've done at some of those events and at conventions and have received some awards with.
Excellent. And also on the line with us is the gentleman who goes by the handle of Rick Starr. Rick, go ahead and tell our audience a little bit about you and your background.
Sure, I'm Rick Starr. I'm from Stratford, Connecticut. I've been into magic since I was 2, doing it for the last 14 years on and off, and this May, doing it professionally. Have my own production company, working on a show where I'll be working for MS. In memory of my mom that I lost in June, we're going to bring a bunch of magicians from all over. It looks like now it's going to be 2 nights instead of 1 night, so it's becoming a really big thing, and I can't wait for that to happen.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, a little bit of background for our listeners who aren't familiar with Josh and Rick. I met these two gentlemen online on streetofcards.tv. If you haven't checked that out, check it out. It is the exclusive video channel just for magic and magicians. And Rick and Josh are active and regular participants in the online real-time chat. And over the last few weeks, we've gotten to know each other online and have had some discussions about common ground that we have as performers. And I thought it might be interesting for our listeners, for Josh and Rick to bring some ideas to the round table for us to talk about as a group and kind of get feedback and discuss and hopefully see what we can do to improve ourselves and improve each other and just talk about the creative process in general. And I'll tell you before we get started, I don't want to spoil the pot here, but I do want to discuss a process that I've kind of tripped across here recently, and this might be a good place to start. I have recently found a process, almost by accident, going through shows that I've been putting together, trying to decide sequencing and how routines can transition in one into the other. And of course, for those of you who know me, I'm big about scripting and having a story to tell. And but one of the things that I started examining in my own work was the purpose of a specific routine. Now, I've been a champion for meaning in magic for years and years, and I believe that every routine should have some intrinsic purpose, motivation, or meaning in it. But what I'm talking about in this regard is, what is the overall purpose that the routine might serve in a show? For example, does this piece introduce the character? Does this piece further establish a character? Does this piece build rapport with the audience? A good example of this might be, for those of you who have seen Jeff McBride perform, his Miser's Dream routine, which brings an audience member, a child, up on stage to perform the Miser's Dream with Jeff. And originally, the Miser's Dream was thought of, you know, to be the fulfillment of one of our basic, you know, needs, one of our basic desires to have riches. But in Jeff's hands, it becomes more than just that, and it serves the purpose in his show of building rapport with the audience, and the child acts as the representative of the audience as a whole. But it's really not just about Jeff and the boy, it's about Jeff and the audience. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. What can a routine, what purpose can a routine serve in a show? And so just to kick us off, that's some food for thought as we get into the discussion and throw some ideas around. What do you guys think about that idea? Josh?
I haven't seen Jeff Smizer's Dream, so I really can't comment too much on it, but I have attended Max Maven's Say Wanna Be a Mentalist seminar, and he does bring up the Miser's Dream concept and talks about it in some depth and how in one person's hands it is just a trick, just pulling coins out of the air, and it's nothing, but he spoke of another magician whose name I'm blanking on and how he became this character. And he just became crazed with the idea of pulling money out of thin air, and you could really see the insanity was causing him. And I think that there's an important lesson to be learned from that for character development, and going back to the meaning and purpose you were speaking of.
Okay. Rick, any thoughts on just that loose, broad concept I laid out there?
I think, you know, bringing people on stage, especially a little kid, like in Jeff's case, he hasn't had problems, but anytime you bring somebody on stage, you always have the fact is, you know, everybody's a good showman, but is that person going to, you know, overshadow the character? Because there are some other characters out there that are real, and when they get on stage and that shows, that could, you know, mess up the magician's concept.
Okay, that's certainly a good concern. Well, let me back up and give another for example. A manipulator might do a silent manipulation piece to music, and the purpose there might be twofold. One to establish skill in the audience's mind. To establish the abilities that the magician has, but I think the primary routine, if it's an opening routine done silently to music, would be more or less to introduce the character to the audience. It's an introduction of sorts, and this is where the whole concept came from, starting with me. I see a lot of magicians who open a show with a silent manipulation routine set to music. But they don't really seem to have any motivation other than, well, I have to open the show this way because I'm all loaded up everywhere and it has to be the first thing to do because I can't, you know, load my jacket anywhere else in the show. But they've not really given much more thought to it than that. I'm sure some of you guys have seen those performers who come out, do a silent routine, but really has little impact, if any impact, on the audience other than just the wow factor. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm driving with that?
Yes.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of the acts, too, don't even have that wow factor. I mean, go to any magic convention, there's a lot of acts that do fall into that.
So by examining that routine and taking it from just what I like to call magical masturbation, and turning it into an introduction of sorts, welcome, ladies, without even saying the words, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, I am your entertainer for the evening, I hope you have a good time. That can be, then that routine can serve an actual physical, real, and tangible purpose in a longer or greater show. It's not just now a standalone throwaway piece that I've worked on for years and years and years, and I have to do it up front because there's nowhere else I could do it. So that's the kind of thing that I've been working through and thinking about in my own magic. Is not just, okay, so this routine tells a story. This routine establishes a character. This routine solves a problem, or this routine teaches a lesson, which are the five purposes of magic in my book, Theatrical Magic, available at www.theatricalmagic.net. I have to get in a little plug there. But beyond those five purposes of magic as theater, thinking about the specific purpose in the order of a show that a routine can serve. And so you can get these different layers of purpose and meaning and really have a lot of fun. And for me, it's really helped clarify and define where a certain piece should fall in a sequence of a show. So let that hang on the clothesline of your mind. And Josh, I'm going to start with you and ask what kind of stuff you've been working on and if there's any pieces that you've been maybe stuck on or struggling with or need a little bit of feedback or just that extra idea that might spark your own creativity.
Well, the biggest thing that I've been working on right now is the video of that Chinese act that I've shown to you and Rick.
Okay.
For those in the audience who aren't familiar with it, it's open with, I toss fortune cookies out into the audience to get volunteers, and they go into Szechuan Sampler, which is basically a mentalism effect where the participants go through the process of ordering food from the different Chinese restaurants, and I'm able to correctly predict how much money they will spend. And that then segues into a close-up act with cards wherein a torn and restored card is found inside of one of the cookies. And I was able to get the flow to work fairly well and just make everything nice and circular as far as I'm concerned that I'm happy with. My biggest problem, though, is just with the routining and making sure that items of interest are going on at all times and making sure that I'm keeping the energy up, which is hard to do sometimes in mentalism, but man, that is something that I'm having a problem with, which is what we're here to discuss.
Right.
So I think that a lot of that could be solved with more effective scripting and character definitions. Actually, have right beside me right now the aforementioned Theatrical Magic by Big Daddy Cool and Script Magic by Pete McCabe. And 26 other guys.
Yeah, great, great book, edited by Pete McCabe and with a lot of great contributors, Scripting Magic. I highly recommend that as well. Of course, I don't get paid for that endorsement, but, well, I'll tell you, Josh, and so let's dig in here to, some of what you described. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Szechuan Sampler, it is a great mentalism piece that, without tipping any methods, basically four different menus from four different Chinese restaurants are given to four different audience volunteers, and they are asked then to choose one item from a different portion of the menu. And the price of that item is noted, and at the end, the four entree prices or dessert prices or prices off that menu are added up and equal the total on the prediction. Is that a pretty fair summary there, Josh?
Right. If I might interject, the way that it's marketed is it comes with a gift certificate and that the total is predicted on that, which I thought was a failing of the trick, because if you're ordering from four different restaurants, from different places, presumably in the world, why would you have one gift certificate for these four different restaurants?
Oh, that's great insight, Josh. That's something that never occurred to me.
And so my solution to that is I just talk about how that as a magician, I go all around the world, and whenever I'm in a new town, I go to the best food I can find, Chinese restaurants. And those are the menus for my favorite places, and of course, on the road, I have so much allotted in my food budget, so I just have one of those envelopes you get from the bank. with money in it, and then that's what matches. And that's a solution. So what my solution to the problem with the gift certificate was, I have the prediction set aside as money in an envelope, so that when the total is revealed, I can have a spectator take the money out of the envelope, and then it matches, and I feel like that gives it more strength and more impact than the gift certificate. It makes more sense. And an unexpected benefit of it I found in a recent performance was it also works as an out, because people don't always add the numbers correctly. They don't always read the right prices off the menu. So as happened to me once, the total that was written down did not in fact match what was in the envelope. Because it was only a dollar off, I was able to, with sleight of hand, just not get that money out of the envelope and show it as empty and have a happy ending, whereas if I was off by one on the gift certificate, it wouldn't have that same amount of impact.
Wow, that's really insightful, Josh. I've seen a lot of people perform Szechuan Sampler. It is actually one of my favorite mentalism effects, and I was even playing around with ideas for myself to do that, and eventually scrapped it. But you know, it's that those little details that you notice that, hey, it doesn't make sense to have a gift certificate for four different restaurants. That kind of detail is something that a lot of magicians would just overlook, and I think that's fantastic. That's spectacular. Your solution with the cash as well is really insightful, because you're right. I've seen many magicians.
It took me about a year to figure that out.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of guys. They turn over that they add that total, and their faces go white because they know that the total on the prediction is printed in black ink, and
right.
It ain't changing.
Yeah.
And so now they've got a problem. So you've effectively solved two really important problems. And I might add one other thing, one other observation about Szechuan Sampler, and this is ultimately why I decided not to do it, was the addition part of it. And what because I'm just not a mathematician. I have number dyslexia to begin with, so if somebody else messes it up, I may or may not know. So I just had to scrap it for myself. But one of the things that I've always thought when I've seen other people perform it is that it might be useful to have a fifth audience member that you give a calculator to. So that they can, you know, make sure that it's absolutely correct. That might be something you want to think about if you're not already doing that.
Right, that is a suggestion that people have had, and even on the cafe, there's a fairly long thread about Szechuan Sampler, and that is a solution that is brought up. The use of a jumbo calculator, and Jason Dean, the magician from Kansas City, suggested that to me as well, but it is a good idea in theory, but aesthetically, I think it's a little tacky. You have people up there, and you have this nice little layout, and then you pull out this big calculator.
Well,
it didn't seem to mesh for my taste.
No, I see where you're going with that. One of the great things about mentalism is that it is intended to reduce the moving parts. You know, Barry Richardson writes about that in Theater of the Mind. You know, creating magic and performing magic and mentalism with as few moving parts as possible. And certainly the addition of that calculator adds one more element, one more moving part. But I would suggest you actually present it to that fifth audience member at the very beginning, and don't even tell them why they're going to use it. You know, just, hey, you're going to use this in a moment. You're going to play a very important role. Something to think about.
Right.
Rick
is on another, sorry.
I was just going to ask Rick if he had any thoughts on that.
I totally agree with Big Daddy Cool that mapping my thing and I wouldn't touch it. But like I said, if you listen to this iPod Go and see Josh's routine, it is good. And you can kind of see, too, that, you can see his cranks running. I think that was maybe another thing he's worried about is, what if I do mess up the amount? Because you got so much things going on, you can tell that in the piece, he was making sure that he calculated right a few times, and that's the thing. And that could work, too, because people would say, oh, he's probably going to get the total wrong, and then when you that could be a misguided, but that, I would stay away from anything with math because the audience would probably beat me in that. But like I said, Josh does it really good, and what we just talked about is that you want to start and finish with a piece that you know you're going to be comfortable with. Just don't start a piece because, like Big Daddy Cool said, your jacket is loaded already. You can come up with other things. You want to start and finish with stuff that are going to get the people staying and talking about you from beginning to end.
Yeah, that's good. And here's an idea for you, Josh. I saw a performer last night on a magic banquet in Canton, Ohio, who recreated some of Thurston's routines. And he actually owns and performs Thurston's original sword cabinet. Pretty cool to see history alive. But one of the things that he did a math routine with a prediction. And he had the prediction on a slate. It was a number prediction. But he also had a small chalkboard that he wrote the numbers on. Again, this is another prop that you have to, work into the aesthetics. But you could actually, as those numbers are called out, write those prices on that chalkboard and do the calculation yourself and ask the audience to check you on it as you go. That might be another way to go on that.
Interesting idea, and definitely something to consider, but the way that I've been doing it now is I usually use a little waiter's hat for the effect, because it would make sense in ordering food, so you're going to write it on there. And actually, when I was at the Midwest Magic Jubilee in St. Louis, I had forgotten my pad at home, so I had to run to the gift shop the night before the competition and just bought a notebook there. And one of the notes that I got from the judges, Jonathan Levitt, said that I should use a little waiter's pad instead of a notepad because it would add to the illusion of me taking their orders. So I think that same thing would hold true whether I used a pad or a blade.
Well, I
add something to that, and it's a souvenir that you can give out at the end.
Sure, and that is a great idea. And I dare say, though, that that note came from the fact that you were using a pad. Had you used a chalkboard or a dry erase board, I don't know that suggestion would have been made. Because the natural inclination there is to go, well, he's using a notepad, but what if instead of a notepad he uses a waiter's order pad?
Right.
So it can go one way or the other. Can go one way or the other, and
oh, definitely.
So that's something to definitely think about. Now, I in our conversations via email and online, one of the critiques I had for you on that routine, and for those of you who wonder what we're talking about Josh Chaykin's Szechuan sampler routine. You can check it out on YouTube. Josh, is it Josh C Magic? Is that the username?
I believe it is. I think I have the video set as private. I only put it up there for specific people to view because YouTube does have a nasty reputation of magic videos being exposed or
gotcha.
Ideas stolen away if they're left unguarded.
Gotcha. Well, so for those of you listening, you can't go see it. But it is... I have seen it, and Rick has seen it. And one of the suggestions that I made to Josh was that at the beginning he tosses out the fortune cookies without any warning to the audience. And I thought that was kind of a dangerous move, Josh, because I once saw a performer toss out candy to an audience and beam a woman right in the eye with a piece of hard candy because she wasn't expecting it. And so I think you need to just introduce the fortune cookies. Hey, I got some fortune cookies here. These are going to be important. I'm going to toss them out to a few people. Get ready to catch them. I think that's just kind of a disclaimer that you needed to have. But I thought using the fortune cookies, and correct me if I'm wrong, you do that to get the volunteers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I thought that was great because you're going to tie that in a little bit later with the card in the fortune cookie.
Right. Originally, the way that I did it was the first time I performed it was in competition setting. So I just had one cookie sitting down on the table, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to need four volunteers for this. And then I had something coming up, doing a show, and I said, well, how can I adapt this for that? And I thought about it, I'm like, well, if I throw the cookies out to the audience, it's a good way to get the volunteers up, and then I had to come up with a solution how to get around with. Because if you toss the cookie out that has a gaffed, falls down and breaks, well, cover's blown. So I had to come up with some creative ways to get around that and ways to reseal the cookie once all the funny business is taken care of. And there's a lot of work that went into this, and it's still a work in progress.
Right, and right now are you using a corner tear?
What I do is, it was an idea that I independently came on, and then I saw it mentioned in Strong Magic as being used in another routine. It is a corner switch, but what I do is because I use the premise of, you know, sending the card back in time to when it wasn't torn, make it restored, and what happens is I turn the card up and I put it inside of a coin envelope. So when what happens in the process of doing that, one of the pieces falls out and I seal the envelope, I notice it too late. So I completely justified matching the corners up with it just looking like it was a complete accident. And it's this really diabolical switch because all the heat is off, nobody's looking for it, it just looks like an afterthought. Oh, well, here, hold on to this, it's a souvenir.
That's actually pretty clever, Josh. That's one of the problems that the corner switch has always had is motivation and justification, and you've just created it. Bravo.
I was so proud of it until I found I wasn't the originator, but it's still something.
Yeah, well, no, it's great, and we're not gonna discuss this here because it would tip some methods, other methods. But I had suggested that there is a method that you could use to have a signature on the face of the card.
Right, and that is something that I considered doing early on, but my problem with that was if I was sending the card back, if the card was signed and I'm sending it back in, Terry, sending it back in time to when it was restored, well, the point that it was restored, it would not necessarily be signed either, so it really didn't seem to fit with the premise I was trying to establish.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right, and in full disclosure, my idea of just using the time travel premise for that was actually a torn and restored that I saw Juan Thomas do up in Toronto, and it fried the hell out of me.
Now, have you, since we're talking about Szechuan Sampler and the climax to the routine is the restoration of the card in the sealed fortune cookie, which has been in full view the entire time. But since we're talking about a monetary prediction with Szechuan Sampler, have you thought about, instead of using a card, using a bill?
No, it's not something that I did consider. It's because I'm mostly a card guy, so my natural inclination is to go towards the card trick. And I do lead off with like an ambitious card as a joke, and think, okay, I take a card, I put it back into the middle of the text, and I'm going to go turn back time a few seconds to when it was on the top. Laymen like it, magicians, you know, roll their eyes.
Right.
And say, okay, well, then I'll prove to you that this time machine really does work. We'll tear the card up, and then we'll send it back in time before it wasn't torn up. And that was my justification for that. So, I mean, I'm not opposed to the idea of using a bill, and it's definitely something I would think about. And there actually is a method out there that uses a bill to go inside the fortune cookie. So something I might look to, but if I think of a good way, good justification, routining and whatnot, to use a bill, it's definitely something I would look into doing.
Yeah, that was just a thought that popped in my head, because you're already dealing with monetary considerations with Szechuan Sampler. It might be a real natural tie-in and a good segue. I might just personally reconsider the time travel premise, because I'm not quite sure I see the connection with the Chinese restaurant theme and the restoration. Can you kind of talk about your thought process there?
Definitely. My pattern is with the Szechuan Sampler is that I really love Chinese food and whatnot, and that's something about me apart from being a magician. And then Szechuan is over, then I go into the card trick. It's almost deliberate to be an abrupt change, and I say, well, another thing about me is I'm a little bit of an amateur scientist, and this is one of my latest inventions. I think that by, when I introduced the time machine, I think that by just making it seem like that each movie is a standalone effect, and then it goes, goes back to the carving the fortune cookie, it brings everything full circle, it was almost out of sight, out of mind for that, so it seems like it gives a bigger impact for the audience. Because I should say that the card doesn't just completely disappear from the envelope. What happens is, when I turn it upside down, a fortune from a fortune cookie flutters out.
Ah, very good. And in stand-up comedy, that's called callback,
right.
And we use that some in theater as well. And so by using that fortune cookie, even though it's a standalone routine, by the card appearing in that fortune cookie, you've called back to the original routine with Szechuan Sampler, and you've reinforced in their minds the amazement that they just experienced with that as well.
Definitely.
Very good. Interesting. Rick, any observations on what Josh and I have been discussing there on that routine?
I think you know, Josh has been working with his trick for a while, and like you said, he got his kinks out, and I think that, you know, he can change it, but it's what's comfortable for him, and like you said, he can see that he's pretty comfortable. He just wants to make sure that it's going to be flawless. I think that's what he's trying to make it better, because he's not happy, he's not happy with certain things, so he's going to change it. And I think it's a good performer. You know that, the audience may like it, but you may say, because you know certain things, like, hey, this is not going to work out, so maybe I need to, use a bill instead of a card, or maybe I should, use something different to make the effect better.
Right. One of the things, Josh, that you and I discussed offline or online was somewhat of your performance persona in establishing that and doing that with costuming. One of the critiques that I would give to you is that I wasn't quite sure who you were on stage from the minute go.
Right.
You know, it took some time to kind of get that sense. And I think that's due in large part, I'm a big believer that costuming is the outward expression of the inner character. And that an audience should be able to look at you on stage and know what you're about, you know, right from the moment go. But it seemed to me that your costuming was a little bit, you know, I don't want to say generic, but there wasn't anything that automatically caught my eye and said, ah, this guy is this type of person or this type of character. Does that make sense?
Yes, and that is actually something that I've been trying to work on for the past couple of years now, our impetus and why I purchased both the book and the scripting one, because I wanted my character to be an extension of myself, an almost exaggeration. Because when I do strolling magic, it's a very high energy, high comedy thing. But I found, unfortunately too late, that when I go to do the stand-up magic, I, for whatever reason, can't get that character to come out. I can't produce that same energy, that same type of character. So I've just been thinking about how I can find a workaround for that, find an alternative character or a better script that would help accentuate what I'm trying to go for.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Why do you think that the character, the persona that you've worked on, maybe rehearsed with, why do you think you're having trouble translating that into actual real-world performance?
Not so much that it's a problem in rehearsal versus actual performance. It's a problem with the transition between the venues. I mean, strolling in a restaurant, performing at a table for 5 or 6 people is very different from being on a stage performing for 30, 40 people.
Ah, okay. I see where you're coming from.
I'm not exactly sure how I can explain it, but I do know that other magicians have, I won't say the same thing, on one of his DVDs, J.J. Sanford says there's a big difference between performing close-up and strolling and doing parlor stage magic. You have to be really, really, really good to make that work. I think because when you're doing strolling, you're just right there one-on-one with those people. It's easier just to relax and be yourself and just play off of each other. When you're up on stage and you're isolated, you really can't really play off anybody until they're actually up on stage, but you have to establish that rapport before you get to that point, and if you fail to do that, you get in the water long before they come up. And I think that's where my problem is. It's just the establishment of that character.
Yeah. That is a huge subject that we could spend hours and hours discussing.
Oh, yeah.
And we will over the next few weeks. For those of you who are listening, we are talking with Josh Chaykin and Rick Starr, and we're getting ready to come to you, Rick. But this is our first ever roundtable on the podcast, on the Theatrical Magic Podcast, and Performance Coach Roundtable. And we're talking about creativity and different problems that we're solving with our creativity and just the creative process in general. And in the weeks to come, we'll be doing more of these roundtables. And we have one coming up on costuming. And Josh and Rick, we may need to pull you guys back in just to talk about character development and character establishment and use that as a completely separate topic, because it's a pretty pretty deep topic to get into, and so we'll set that aside for another day. Josh, any other thoughts or insights on Szechuan Sampler and your Chinese restaurant routine? Anything else you want to share?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I think we really hit a lot of the pertinent points. And as far as what my additions and solutions to what I felt were inherent problems in it were, but there's, like you mentioned, you still have to have the justification for it, and why are we bringing out, why are we taking this imaginary trip to these restaurants? And what I've been doing with that is that I, to me, these are my favorite restaurants, and I have jokes about the location of each one and whatnot, and it's, I'm asking the audience to help me decide what to order when I should go back to those places. And it's not the best solution because of how you have to have them order. It's not quite as contrived as some of the other performances I've seen, but it, not something I'm completely happy with right now.
So that might be the motivation for the menus and the action is something you're still kind of struggling with. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, because I say these are my favorite. Whenever I'm in the new town, I go out for Chinese. And these are menus from four of my favorite places, and I can never decide what to order when I go out to these places, so I need four people to help me, so someone just order the dessert, the entree, the side dish, and the appetizer, one from each restaurant. And then, of course, they go through all of that, and the total matches the amount of money that I have set aside.
So,
my problem with that is they're helping order the meal, but I'm getting the dessert from California, but the side dish from Maine,
right,
from Oklahoma.
Well, maybe the motivation is as simple as this, Josh. Most Chinese restaurants have a pretty common menu to them, and I'd love to hand out a menu from my all-time favorite, but unfortunately, I only have one from each one. There are four of you on stage, so we're gonna do the best we can. So they're different one from each of you, but they all have common menu items on them, and they're all roughly about the same price. And I think most people who have eaten at Chinese restaurants do realize that.
Oh, definitely.
So obviously that's not a completed thought right there, but that might be one direction that you can examine and just provide that little extra layer of motivation and justification for the four different menus. I think that the four different menus do make it a little bit more the end revelation stronger, because it makes it seem that much more random.
Right.
So that may be a little issue that you need to dance around a little bit. So I'll be interested to see where you go with that and how you examine that and develop that further. So keep us tuned in. So for those of you listening, Josh is going to update us on his progress on finding motivation for the four different menus in Szechuan Sampler. And that's going to end this first segment.